Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Mandla, your weekly news show with briefings and analysis from the continent of Africa, from a progressive Pan-Africanist point of view. And I'm Doug Miller, here with Gwen Shulman.
Here, this time, is we are in Malawi, not in Montreal, and you're about to listen to a rebroadcast because Doug and I are away for Malawi, 1 month, actually. And in the time that we're there, we hope to do some great radio so that when we're back home in Montreal, there's going to be some good, fresh interviews for all of you to listen to. But in the meantime, we've picked some of our favorite shows from the last year to rebroadcast while we're away.
So stay tuned. Africa Unite, Fatsilele.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you in English and French here on CQT 90.3 FM. We are still broadcasting from the comfort of our homes, hoping to get back in the studio soon. I'm here with Doug, and we just had an absolutely amazing conversation with Dan O'Meara. He's a South African. He was a longtime militant of the African National Congress. Went on to become a professor of political science at UQAM here in Montreal. And we wanted to talk to Dan about what is currently going on in South Africa. There is a lot of action in the streets following the incarceration of the former president, Jacob Zuma. So anyway, we dive deep into that. And with Dan O'Meara, it's always deep. It's always fascinating and it's always accessible. So please stay tuned. I think you're really going to enjoy this. Bonsoir et bienvenue à Amandla, une heure d'analyse et de nouvelles du continent africain. Ce soir, nous vous proposons un tout petit documentaire sur la merveilleuse Miriam Makeba, chanteuse sud-africaine, militante sud-africaine. Quelque chose qui explique un peu son histoire qui est peut-être pas très bien connu. Alors, restez à l'écoute d'Amandla, ici à CKUT 90.3 FM.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Amandla. The news from South Africa has been astounding for the last 2 weeks. A protest that began ostensibly because the former president Jacob Zuma was finally incarcerated for contempt of court, of all things, but is on trial for corruption. And KwaZulu-Natal, his home state, erupted in protest that quickly turned to an unexpected direction of looting stores and shopping centers and malls that spread to Gauteng, which is the province where Johannesburg and Pretoria are the main urban mining industrial sector of the country, and has led to huge outpourings of upset over everything that's wrong with South Africa, not just Jacob Zuma's arrest. So we thought that we better take a look at this news in a little more depth by going to somebody that we all know and respect a great deal as a public intellectual and mentor. And Dan O'Mara has guided us very often on South African and South Africa issues. So we sat with him earlier this morning and had a long chat about what's going on in South Africa. So here it is. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, listeners of Amandla, we are here tonight with Dan O'Mara from South Africa. Gwen and I are extremely concerned. We're longtime watchers and concerned global citizens about the situation in South Africa and very concerned about how things have been spiraling in a very wrong direction for a little while now. But things came to a head July, I believe it was 7th, when Jacob Zuma submitted himself to imprisonment. He drove to the prison at the demand of the High Court. And from there, protests arose in KwaZulu-Natal for sure, and up in Gauteng around Johannesburg. And holy smokes, they were not just picket signs and a few rocks thrown at police, but a wide scale looting. So Dan, we were hoping, could help bring us into that picture. And that, the part of the reason for that is I know from Dan's own personal history that Dan, you were working with Jacob Zuma in Mozambique when you were there as a university lecturer and an ANC militant. Can you tell us a little bit about the Jacob Zuma you knew and how you think it went wrong?
Well, I ask myself that question almost every day, Doug, because the Jacob Zuma with whom I worked, I didn't work very closely with him. You know, we weren't intimate friends, but I ran a number of courier missions for him to Swaziland, and I worked with him on the ANC intelligence group. And he was the chief rep chief representative of the ANC in Maputo at the time. And I, like every other comrade, thought he was the bee's knees. I mean, we really were proud of him. And if we had time, I could go into great details. I mean, there was a moment in a celebration of the 70th anniversary of the ANC when he did something which would take too long to recount, but which the Mozambicans who were there came to me afterwards and said that, "I wish our leaders were like that." I mean, he seemed to be a man who embodied the Mandela qualities of leadership. And, you know, literally we would have given our lives for him. So that was the Jacob Zuma that I thought I knew. And the Jacob Zuma who basically came to power as vice president under Thabo Mbeki and then president after kicking Mbeki out was a totally different kettle of fish. Feet of clay says it all. But how we got from A to Z is something that really I don't know. I mean, I didn't know the man well enough and I can't do a psychological profile. I read a whole lot of nonsense, including from the former leader of the opposition, Helen Zille, who blames it all on African feudalism, which is, you know, just another racist way of saying the problem is black people, not us white people. But I think, you know, in the end, Zuma has been corrupted by power.
Well, just to say, and corrupted, I mean, corrupted at an extent that's quite remarkable. My goodness gracious, it started very early on.
It started very early on. And I think the real issue was, in a sense, I mean, if we're asking where to pin the blame is on the strategy of the white elite to co-opt a black elite. Because if you think about the ANC leadership that was in exile, and I'm not talking about the Mandelas of the world, because Mandela immediately started earning lots of money from his book royalties and didn't ever have a problem. And his salary as president, he didn't ever have a problem of how to live. But people like Zuma who had, you know, the ANC didn't pay its cadres underground. It fed them and it housed them. And suddenly they were thrown deep end into a capitalist society where they had to have bank accounts and credits and cars and all of this. and still no salary. And where do they get it? And along come the banks, and I know this from deep personal experience, who started offering lines of credit to these people and free motor cars. I mean, a close friend of mine was elected to parliament, and the day he was elected to parliament in 1994, I was with him celebrating, and the telephone ran, and it was Mercedes-Benz or BMW, I forget which, offering him a free car. So, you know, suddenly by being in the new political leadership, you were given access to goodies that you hadn't, quote, earned in inverted commas under the capitalist system, but you were kept on credit. And as long as you towed the line, and this friend of mine I spoke about was at a dinner party with a series of bankers who were pointing out leading black politicians saying, that one is ours, that one is ours, and that one is ours. And my friend said, how do you mean he's ours? He said, he has a line of credit with us. So their entire lifestyle became, and this very luxurious lifestyle of this new black elite, was not based on production, was not based on them becoming, you know, the kind of bourgeoisie that developed in other countries where they opened their own factories and did their own thing. It was based on their links to power and the way they towed the lines of what essentially the banks wanted. And Zuma got sucked into that very early on. And I know another comrade who I met subsequently. I didn't know him during the struggle, but I met him in 2014, who had known Zuma in Tanzania and said Zuma's problems were always women and money. And the two go together because Zuma was accused of rape. We must never forget this.
Absolutely.
And, you know, most people are totally convinced he was guilty, including the woman who accused him of rape and who died later. And, you know, the South African feminist woman movement has totally distanced itself from Zuma. Zuma, in the minds of most South Africans, is a rapist who got off only because there was a reactionary white judge. So you see the moral and the personal, financial and political corruption of the man. And we must never forget that when we talk about corruption, there are two sides to corruption. There's the money side, which I've spoken about, you know, banks give you lines of credit. But there's also the political side. And the political side is when big men, and they're usually men, very few women occupy those kinds of positions. They get used to power and they do whatever is necessary to use that power. You know, as Lord Acton put it, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And somebody like Thabo Mbeki, who was Mandela's successor, I don't believe was ever corrupt in the financial sense, but was politically corrupt in the most deep sense, where he became so used to being the person who decided, he redeployed and got rid of any potential questioning of his own judgment. So there was a dual track corruption process going on literally from the day that Mandela was inaugurated as South African president, and for which Mandela himself bears a heavy responsibility in choosing Mbeki, in choosing and making a series of policy decisions. So there was a slow process which, you know, turned somebody who was quite magnificent, as it did in a different way to Winnie Mandela. It wasn't the same kind of corruption, but the celebrity corrupted Winnie Mandela, and power and money corrupted Jacob Zuma. And spectacularly, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars.
Billions. Yes, and of course, we mustn't forget the corruptors and the Gupta family, for instance, state capture, and those people that benefited from the contracts by being close to power.
State capture is one thing, Doug, and you know, all of the so-called respectable bourgeoisie in South Africa has distanced itself from state capture because they can blame state capture on the Gupta family. So the Guptas were this Indian family that arrived. They were not South Africans, they just arrived, and through Zuma's connections with the intelligence services managed to get him lines of credit. But for the white bourgeoisie can say, no, this is not us, we are the respectable, we don't do those kinds of things. But at the bottom of the whole sick saga of corruption in South Africa is this desperate and successful attempt of the old white economic power structure to hold on to their privileges and to make certain that socialist aspects of the ANC program were never implemented. So these aspects, the bankers that I'm talking about, weren't themselves, and their enterprises weren't themselves necessarily involved in state capture. So that the corruption of state capture, which was monumental, is one thing, but underlying that is this tendency to make sure that going way back from 1990 onwards, that the power, the white power holders would co-opt morally, politically, and ideologically a new black elite. We call them the black diamonds because they're rare and they shine very brightly, and would make certain that virtually nothing changed for the majority of the black population who were terribly oppressed under apartheid.
In a sense, it was a capture of any potential of revolutionary change. That was the first capture.
Absolutely, and it was facilitated, you know, by the assassination of Chris Hani, the leader of the South African Communist Party, and the premature death of some of the old stalwarts on the left, like Joe Slovo, so yes, but there's a long process. It's not just Jacob Zuma. It's not just even the corrupt elements of the ANC. And the people in the Democratic Alliance, which is the main opposition party, who claim, you know, this is all this terrible African kleptocracy, which they go on about. I mean, they are the people who are fundamentally responsible for this and claim the innocence of, you know, whoever. It really is revolting what is going on in South Africa at the moment.
Now, with his, what would we call it, he turned himself into prison. So we could anticipate some blowback from that, especially since he ensconced himself in KwaZulu Natal, sort of the homeland. And of course, the KwaZulu Natal has a long history of using violence as a political tool enforcing their will on things. So we could have anticipated some blowback, but so much of what's coming out of the media right now is that it was due to the imprisonment of Zuma. So one would think that the targets would be then state institutions of power, the police, the courts, the jails, or whatever represented state power. But holy smokes, it went way beyond that to the looting of foodstuffs and commercial goods. It seems that the story is quite complicated, and it's not just a simple protest against the arrest of Zuma.
No, it's incredibly complex, Doug. I don't think there's any doubt that the imprisonment of Zuma was the catalyst. And I don't think there's much doubt either that the beginnings of the quote protest that turned violent, and it was always going to go that way, I don't think there's any doubt that it was coordinated and planned. I mean, you know, the South African press is publishing Twitter and other kinds of messages that come firstly from Zuma's children, his three children, his two sons and his daughters, which are openly calling for revolt and revolution and violence. And African intelligence services, which are linked to Zuma because his role in the ANC intelligence services goes back decades. So there was clearly a kind of instigation of violence from elements that are beginning to be named, and Ramaphosa, the president, has said these people will be prosecuted. But, I mean, the context, as you say, is far more complex. And, you know, I'm going to ask for a little indulgence here because I've been trying to untangle all of the elements. And I think that there are at least five or six elements that we need to bear in mind. I mean, you know, it's almost like you ask people to imagine that a Martian comes to Earth with five eyes, and each eye sees a different thing, but the brain integrates this into one image. So we have to look, first of all, at each of the images that we see with these five eyes, and then try and bring it all into one overall image. So that Zuma's own personal legal situation, and his legal situation is dire, because he's been imprisoned for 15 months just on a charge, of disrespecting the court. I mean, he was ordered to appear before a commission of inquiry that he himself instigated, and he just refused. So finally, he's been found in contempt of court. He's been in prison. He's in prison for contempt of court. He is also actually undergoing a trial for corruption. that goes back to the big, huge, unnecessary and totally corrupt deal that was done with to rearm the South African security service, the South African military. Totally unnecessary in the late 1990s. It was part of the compromise that was done with the old power structures. The military wanted new toys, and the ANC agreed to give them, spend billions of dollars rather than, you know, spending it on education and healthcare services. So Zuma's legal situation is the underlying precipitating event, but it's just the catalyst. It's not the cause. The second thing is that there is an immense struggle for power going on in the ANC. And this struggle for power goes back, you know, some people say to 2017 when Ramaphosa was elected president. Some people say to 2008 when Zuma managed to engineer a coup d'etat against Thabo Mbeki. Others say it goes back to 1996 when Thabo Mbeki himself organized a coup within the ANC parliamentary caucus and the government to get rid of the reconstruction and development program. So there is an ongoing struggle for power. But the struggle for power over the last 5 years has become particularly intense. And very schematically, we can say that there are two factions. The one faction has coalesced. It's an alliance that has coalesced around Zuma, which is basically the rule of the corrupt. And it's not only in KwaZulu. I mean, the man who was elected by a majority of 24 votes out of 4,600 to the key post of General Secretary of the ANC, Ace Magashule, has been suspended. It took Ramaphosa almost 4 years to be able to do that. And he himself is fighting his suspension and he's been accused of corruption. He's facing formal charges for corruption. And he's from the Free State, he's not from KwaZulu-Natal. And other people like him are facing corruption charges and they're fighting back. And these are the people who have coalesced around Zuma and coalesced around state capture. They weren't all of them involved with the Gupta family that I mentioned, this Indian family. But this struggle for power is really intense and it's not given who is going to win. I mean, looks like the Ramaphosa faction is slightly dominant at the moment. And the, whatever we want to call it, insurrection riots that of 2 weeks, a week, 2 weeks ago, was partly inspired by this, an attempt to create chaos around this. The other coalition is around Ramaphosa, and these are the people who are for a kind of constitutional democracy. You know, and they're not all lily white, you know, forgive the metaphor, they're not all clean themselves. Some of them have dubious pasts, like the vice president, and Ramaphosa himself is not the cleanest of the clean, but they do seem to be defending the constitution, which is positive. You know, can't have an attack on democracy in South Africa, given the price that we paid for that democracy. So there's that. And that the call by Zuma's children and then groups around them to revolt was an attempt by this group that seems to be progressively being frozen out to recapture some kind of terrain and to make it more difficult. Complicating the fact of that, and now we come back to KwaZulu-Natal, is what is going on in the Zulu royal family. Because King Goodwill Zwelithini died in March. He'd been the Zulu king for 30, 40 years. And there's now a huge power struggle in the Zulu royal family. His queen regent, given the way the Zulu royal family functions, she was supposed to be the person who held power, his first wife, what is called the great wife. But she died a month later. So now there's this huge struggle for power within the Zulu royal family, which is not just a struggle for power, but it's also a struggle for who inherits the vast wealth that goes with being the king of the Zulus. And literally there's a court case about, you know, who's going to inherit and whether the will was of King Goodwill was forged or not. I mean, we're in Dickens kind of territory here, but it's also the Zulu king controls a trust, a land trust, which is the biggest single land holding in South Africa. So, you know, and this is linked to the decline of Mangosuthu Buthelezi's party and this whole very nebulous role of so-called tribalism, which is not really tribalism in KwaZulu-Natal, so that there this struggle over Zuma was in a sense the political figure who both represented the corrupt side of the ANC and a certain tendency within the allied to the Zulu royal family. And it's not clear who's going to win out because the stakes are very high. It's about patronage and control over land and control over resources and who gets to be wealthy. And we must never forget that in the municipal elections of, I think it was 2016, over 50 ANC municipal councillors were killed in KwaZulu-Natal by other candidates for the post of ANC municipal councillor, because whoever gets to occupy political office gets access to the lines of credit that I was talking about, gets access to the goodies. It is their passage out of poverty. So that political power in South Africa, in the new quote, democratic South Africa, given that there has been no attempt to improve or very little attempt to improve the economic situation of the vast mass of Black South Africans, everybody knows that if you have links to the ANC, you then have links to patronage, you can escape poverty. So there's that going on. There's also, you know, I'm sorry to go on like this, but there's
no, please, this is wonderful. It's such a clear analysis, and I think it's really contextualizing what we need to know about South Africa right now.
There's also a struggle within the intelligence services, because the intelligence services, you know, were the great nebulous element that was created after 1994. And we must never forget that the, quote, democratic South Africa that was created in 1994 was in fact a bastard child. You know, and I'm, again, I apologize for the language, but there's no other way to see it, because it was a sort of forced marriage between the old apartheid structures, the security and military establishment that had, you know, gone on this campaign of mass murder inside South Africa and outside in surrounding countries in the 70s and 80s. None of them were prosecuted. They all managed to cling on to power, and they were all given posts in the government, and the ANC, PAC, and the Bantustan security forces. They were all meshed in this kind of weird and wonderful security establishment, military and intelligence. And the intelligence services, there has been a huge fight in the intelligence services since that day over who gets to control the information and the analysis of information that is fed into the power holders. At one stage, during Mandela's presidency, Thabo Mbeki, who was then the vice president, said that there was a plot by Cyril Ramaphosa and the others to overthrow Mandela, because he was being told this by the intelligence services. It was all nonsense, but it was again the struggle over power, and that has not stopped. And Zuma was really key in this, because he was the head of the ANC intelligence unit or section from 1980 onwards, throughout the 1980s. So the people who are in place now all came to a certain extent through their connections with Zuma. And the kinds of information that is being fed to Ramaphosa, who didn't have those links, is vitally important. So who gets to control the intelligence services is also a key issue. Now, the other complicating factor in this power struggle is that Ramaphosa is the first of the non-exile people to take to hold the key position in the ANC. When the ANC was legalized in 1990, the exile movement moved back into South Africa and essentially took control of the old United Democratic Front and COSATU, and basically got rid of, I'm simplifying, you know, absurdly, but essentially the old exile leadership, which had never really been democratic because they were fighting a clandestine struggle and they couldn't vote. You know, when you open fire on your enemy, you don't take a vote about this. They essentially froze out much of the old most of the old internal, much more democratic kind of leadership. And Ramaphosa is the first one to come through from this. He was kicked out in 1996 by Mbeki, and he came back. So there are all these elements, but it's a new generation as well, because the old struggle generation is now, you know, people of your and my age, we're in our 70s and even older, and, you know, we're not going to be here forever, and there's a new generation coming through. So all of this is incredibly nebulous, but underlying it, and this is the fundamental issue. The revolt, so-called revolt insurrection, was about all of this. It was incited, but in the end, it was South Africa's a tinderbox. And these kinds of struggles they were the spark that lit the fire that was always going to happen. It's happened in other kinds of incidences. We've seen it with these horrendous attacks on so-called, you know, the so-called xenophobic attacks on other Africans, Zimbabweans or Nigerians or Rwandese who are there.
Mozambicans, Malawians, Congolese.
Yeah, you name it. And, you know, there are millions of refugees from the rest of Africa in South Africa. I heard more French in the streets of Cape Town than I ever hear in Westmount in Montreal, for example. but, you know, the tinderbox of South Africa is the fact of this immense poverty. First reports that came out, everybody was saying that most of the people who were involved in the looting, they weren't doing this because Zuma told them to do so. They were doing this because they were hungry.
Yeah.
And they saw opportunity. So that, you know, the chickens have come home.
But are the hungry people perhaps the sixth eye and the sixth possible, I mean, power broker would be too strong a word, but we don't know. I mean, all of these people who are so hungry, who do not have work, who have been so completely screwed over by that whole portrait that you just drew, are, you know, potentially that sixth force that, you know, have perhaps even seized this moment of a political struggle and stepped in and said, whoa, you know, what about us? And we need food and we're just going to go and we're going to take it. And from what I've been reading, it's more than they've moved beyond blockades and whatever, and they're actually fighting the police back and not running away from the police and, you know, standing ground and saying, we've had it.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think it's complicated again, you know, and everything in South Africa is complicated because there's no doubt that, you know, I think the first people who did the protest were inspired by Zuma. But when it became clear, hey, we can get food, you know, those people who, I mean, we cannot imagine the situation of most South Africans. South Africa is more unequal today than it was in the worst period of apartheid. And it's absolutely true that the overwhelming majority, 99.99% recurring, of the poor in South Africa are Black, and the vast majority of the not so poor or the well off are white. And, you know, if you're going to be born in South Africa, have a white skin, black skin, if you're born with a white skin, your chances are million times better than they are in life than if you're born with a black skin. So yes, those kinds of people, the people who looted and took food, they came from that. But in doing so, you know, I hear this from my sister, who's talking to the people who work for her. The woman who works for her couldn't get anywhere to get food because there were riots and there was no more food available. So it was, in a sense, you know, it's like the workers in the US who support Trump, they're shooting themselves in the foot. Mm-hmm. There is this, okay, you can raid a food store and burn it down and you might eat for a week or two, but what do you do after that? Mm-hmm. And that one of the other reporting that is coming out is that many of the groups that then formed to stop this were also composed of the poor. Mm-hmm. So that what these events have done has to put in focus for almost everybody. Everybody who has half an eye open and who's not, you know, around the Democratic Alliance, which is the essentially white opposition saying it's all Black people's fault. Anybody who has half an eye open, whether it's one or six or two or three or, you know, whatever, issue in South Africa is poverty. Mm-hmm. And the issue in South Africa is that nobody's done anything about poverty. The ANC has now been in power for 27 years. You cannot go on blaming the old white power structure or apartheid. What have you done? You know, and Zuma has done nothing. And this, I want to come back here to talk about something that strikes me as very important, because there's a misapprehension on the left in North America about the so-called faction around Zuma, which has now christened itself the Radical Economic Transformation Faction.
Oh my gosh, disgusting.
You know, and the press is going on about the so-called danger from the left, the so-called, the people who are radical economic transformation. When I hear these people talk about radical economic transformation, these are exactly the corrupt people that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. who have been in power for 27 years, who have got personally exceptionally wealthy and live the most corrupt lifestyle possible and have done zero to aid the poor people. They are as much about radical economic transformation as Adolf Hitler was about socialism. And we should never forget that the official title of the Nazi Party had the word socialist in it. Yeah. There was zero socialism in Nazism, just as there's zero radical economic transformation. This is a pure blind to try and, you know, con black South Africans, poor black South Africans, into thinking that if you stay with Zuma and Ace Magashule and people like that, your lot will get better. It won't. And the economic freedom fighters, you know, of Julius Malema, are exactly the same. They are out and out fascists who are themselves personally corrupt, who bankrupted one of the biggest banks in South Africa which was founded to aid the poor. You know, they did this by their own personal corruption. So don't be confused by this notion that there is a so-called tendency which is now being persecuted by Ramaphosa, which is for radical economic transformation. Mm-hmm. This is nonsense. These people do not want radical economic transformation. All they want to do is to be freed from persecution, prosecution, and be allowed to go on milking the, you know, the cow of corruption that they have been doing for 27 years.
Well, it reminds me so much of Mugabe in Zimbabwe with the land redistribution program, you know, and the leftists around the world gathered around him because finally there was going to be fundamental change in Zimbabwe, and it was all about redistributing land to cronies, and you know, it was disgusting.
Exactly.
You know. But do you think there's any possibility under Ramaphosa that he can make some change that would redeem the ANC a bit?
Well, it depends what you mean by change, Doug. I think, you know, let's put it this way. Ramaphosa is a very different kettle of fish to the, as I've said, suggested, not just because his political history is different, but he was a trade union leader. I mean, that's how he came into prominence. He knows how to negotiate. He knows how to play a long game. And I think he's playing a very long game, by which I mean that, and I could be 180 degrees out of line here, but I think that he's, you know, he's decided that it is absolutely essential to get rid of the corrupt elements in the ANC, but he has to proceed very cautiously because, you know, we come back to the election in the ANC Congress of 2017, 4,700 people voted for the president, and Ramaphosa of the ANC, not the country yet, Ramaphosa won by 179 votes out of 4,700.
Ooh, that's tight.
So he doesn't have a huge mandate. And the person he lost to was Zuma's ex-wife, Nkosasana Dlamini, who I don't think is personally corrupt, but she's associated with those factions. So, you know, it's not all plain sailing for Ramaphosa. He has to move very cautiously. Next year is the quinquennial ANC Congress. This is going to be the big sign. What happens between now and 2022, in December 2022, when the election will be held? There will be a cleaning of house, I think, an attempted cleaning of house. Ramaphosa cannot ignore what happened. And he said in his address to the nation that the people who instigated this uprising, and I think it's clear that, you know, the South African press has named 12 people, that those people will be prosecuted. And I think that will weaken, if that happens, that will weaken the corrupt faction again. Will Ramaphosa recognize that the fundamental issue is poverty? I think he knows that, but his hands are tied. His hands are tied by the fact that he himself is part of the extreme wealthy. I mean, he's one of the richest men in Africa. And, you know, he went from being a trade union leader to being given control of one of the biggest mining groups. So, you know, where he stands himself, and he didn't come exactly innocent out of the Marikana massacre in 2012. Can he institute, and can the ANC institute, a process of genuine opening up of the economy? I don't think so. I think the forces arrayed against them are too strong.
I wonder, I have another question, coming back to the whole corruption issue and the focus on corruption, which is obviously legitimate. We see that from this conversation, but does it also then just become an excuse for the government to not address issues? I mean, look, let's face it, this became an issue around food. And we know in South Africa that the food chain has become completely controlled by multinational corporations. There's the whole supermarket structure in South Africa. Food is expensive, it's inaccessible in a context where there's high unemployment and great poverty. So there's this whole economic structure of oppression that's going on that doesn't get discussed when the focus is on political corruption.
Well, I think there are four issues around that. I mean, there's food, there's transport, because you're right. I mean, the food sources are increasingly in malls. And it's interesting that these groups attack the malls, because that's where supermarkets are.
Very much so.
But for the poor to get to the malls, they've got to get transport. You know, I mean, some of them are a long way away, and particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, which is incredibly hilly. I mean, people walk very long distances. And the prevailing mode of transport is taxis. And the taxi industry is one of the most violent and corrupt, because it's also extremely profitable for those who own the mini taxis. And that got disrupted. And it was interesting that the taxi owners then became part of the resistance against the revolts. There's health. I mean, you know, part of the attacks were against hospitals. And this, to me, is, you know, you ask, why do poor Black people burn down hospitals? It's almost a symbol of, well, if we can't get access to healthcare, nobody's going to get access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. And COVID makes this incredibly urgent. Yeah. And we all know that COVID is rampant in South Africa, and the effects of this, the events of the last 2 weeks, have sent the COVID figures spiraling. And the fourth issue is education. And all of these require massive finance and massive state intervention. And the prevailing orthodoxy in South Africa and in the rest of the world, you know, Joe Biden notwithstanding, who is slowly maybe beginning to turn this around a little bit, is that we must let the sacrosanct free market deal with this. Well, the free market doesn't deal with that at all, except to make people more, a very small majority, rich, and make it more and more difficult for the mass of the excluded to get access to these things. So the issue in the end comes around to whether the people who are the victims, the real victims of both this violence and of the still discriminatory democracy that is included in South Africa, are they going to start organizing themselves? Are they going to look to the ANC as the savior? And, you know, I think this mentality of the liberation movement really needs to be done away with. I mean, the ANC, yes, it was the glorious liberation movement, but it did not liberate South Africa on its own. It was far more the internal democracy that did it. The population needs to get rid of this notion that this is the solution to our problems. And there needs to go back to a really core level of organization. There is a new...
That's going on, no?
It is, to some extent, you know, but it needs to go beyond a kind of local level. And it needs to be geared around much more local level empowerment, and it needs to refuse this notion of incorporation. There is a fascinating interview on this new blog, this new group, new media in South Africa called New Frame.
Yeah, fantastic.
An interview with Jay Naidu. Jay Naidu was the founding general secretary of KwaSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and he was the minister responsible for the reconstruction and development program in Mandela's cabinet, and he was the principal victim with Ramaphosa of Mbeki's coup d'etat. And, you know, he talks about how this happened and why, what kinds of new movements are necessary. And he wrote a book that came out 3 or 4 years ago called Change, which is really a really interesting book about how local level change needs to break with this idea that we just look to political inspiration from the great liberation movement. And it's, you know, his ideas are the kinds of ideas that seem to me to be very important. And I am personally inspired by people like Jay, you know, who have not got rich under apartheid, have remained true to what they believed in, unlike the people we started with Zuma, and how did Zuma go from A to Z. There is a lot of this going on in South Africa that we don't hear about. And that is, for me, the positive thing. And hopefully this, the events of the past 2 weeks will shine a greater light on this, and these kinds of groups will be able to exert greater pressure on the state. But in the end, we come down to the issue that there is no way around state politics. Who controls the state is a fundamental issue. And there, you know, the left, not just in South Africa, but everywhere in the world, and I've said this to you guys before, needs to start thinking about an alternative model, about how do we get, once popular groups are in power, how do they prevent exactly the kind of co-option and exactly the kind of manipulation of market forces to make sure that real radical social change and economic change doesn't occur. And we don't have a roadmap. We don't yet, you know, I don't know anybody who does. Questions are urgent, and they're linked now with a question of not just health, COVID, they're linked with a question of the survival of the human race, given the environmental crisis. So we're in a pivotal moment in South Africa, as we are in the rest of the world. You know, I woke up this morning and read the news to see that 12 people drowned in a tunnel, in a train tunnel in China because of flooding. You know, we looked at the floods in Germany. The environmental crisis is changing the ball game totally. And we cannot rely on old style market forces to save us. They've never saved us in the past. And we've got to get rid of this ridiculous idea. And it's ridiculous. And allow me to say one final thing. The whole idea that the market will save us is ridiculous because it ignores the history of capitalism. Nowhere in the world, starting with Great Britain, and then the United States or Germany, did the market create capitalism? It was the state that intervened to create capitalism. And the question of who controlled the state and how state power was used in Britain, in the United States, in Germany, in France, everywhere, in China, in South Korea, this was the issue that made the development of capitalism possible. So the myth of the market is a lie. The free market was never free. The state intervened to make the market what it was, and every country that industrialized, industrialized with the state protecting the local industry. And, you know, we need a kind of government that is going to recognize that humanity is now faced with a kind of threat that it's never been faced with before. The riots in South Africa, environmental crisis, all of those things are immediate and pressing and have to be dealt with.
Wow, that's a powerful statement. I'm not sure there's much more to add after that. Have you got anything, Gwen?
I think it's good to end it right here. It's a horribly, horribly negative, but potentially inspiring all at the same time.
absolutely
It's important to say that it's not negative.
No, it's not. I mean, it's
to recognize that we have an immense challenge.
One element I haven't seen us touch, and that's probably the direction of questions I led, is the power of youth on the African continent. They are leading the charge in so many ways, in so many places. The youth revolts in South Africa against fees, university fees, were inspirational. And the kids were so smart and articulate. It was really wonderful, not to mention Nigeria and, of course, Algeria and the Sudan and so on. So I'm...
And they might be able to extricate themselves from that liberation movement logic that, Dan, that you were referring to. The younger generations are less and less tied, probably, I would imagine, emotionally tied to that model. And
I would agree with that 100%, you know, but I would add a word of caution. I think Doug and my generation, we had the youth revolt and all the great hopes and blah, blah, blah. And look where it led. I mean, you know, the hopes of 1968 ended up with globalization.
Well, that's what you were saying. I mean, it's this endless subversion. And how do you break that cycle?
So that what the youth need to be thinking about, you know, I don't mean to be telling them, hey, guys, that is again the question of power. It's not enough to revolt. I mean, the Arab Spring, again, showed. They brought down Mubarak in Egypt, and what happened? Hey, the same guys are still in power.
Yep.
You know, so yes, there is this need to organize and revolt, but to think theory, to really seriously decide how we're going to get not just from A to B, but from A to Z.
Yeah.
And, you know, really change the kind of social societies that we live in.
Well, again, on behalf of Amandla, I thank you, Dan, for an amazing elucidation of what's going on and insights to it and a global vision that it entails, which lets us all know that Africa and the world are one in the future and outcomes. So thanks again, and we'll look forward to more of these discussions in the future. Hopefully, we'll start getting some good news in the near future.
Sakuka sati bega nansi patapat.
Cette chanson qui a fait le tour du monde à la fin des années 60 a peut-être éclipsé un peu son autrice, une femme engagée, exilée et pour qui la musique permettait de tisser des liens entre les cultures. Myriam Makeba trouvait sa chanson Patapata insignifiante. Elle l'a chantée parce que son public lui réclamait. C'est un titre qu'elle compose et écrit à la fin des années 50. Les paroles sont en Xhosa, une langue d'Afrique du Sud que la chanteuse connaît bien et maîtrise bien, contrairement aux Occidentaux. C'est ce qu'elle aimait rappeler dans un autre titre connu sous le nom de Click Song.
Xhosa is my native language. And back home, the English-speaking people call it the Click Song. Only because they cannot say Opamata.
Myriam est d'ailleurs un prénom d'emprunt. La chanteuse s'appelle en réalité Zenzile. Dans la tradition Xhosa, on nomme les enfants selon les circonstances de la naissance. Pour Zenzile, l'accouchement a été très délicat et sa grand-mère, présente à ce moment important, n'arrêtait pas de répéter à sa fille « Ouzenzile », qui veut dire « tu ne peux t'en prendre qu'à toi-même ». Zenzile a passé les premières semaines de sa vie en prison avec sa mère qui fabriquait de l'alcool pour survivre. Une activité interdite aux populations noires à cette époque en Afrique du Sud. Jeune fille, elle quitte vite l'école pour travailler, elle sera mariée, battue par son mari. Seule la musique et sa voix incroyable vont la sortir de cette ville. Elle se fait vite repérer et intègre au début des années 50 un groupe vocal très à la mode, les Manhattan Brothers. C'est là qu'elle prend son nom de scène, Myriam Makeba. Quelques années plus tard, un réalisateur américain lui propose de jouer son rôle et d'interpréter deux chansons dans un film anti-apartheid, Come Back Africa. L'année de la sortie du film, en 59, elle se retrouve à Venise, Paris et Londres pour présenter le film. En quittant l'Afrique du Sud, la chanteuse ne sait pas encore qu'elle ne pourra y revenir que 31 ans plus tard.
En août
1960, ma mère est décédée. Mon étonnement, quand je suis allée au consulat sud-africain, they stamped my passport annulled. And since then, I've never been able to go back home. I wasn't able to go to my mother's funeral.
Sa participation au film l'a contraint à l'exil. Grâce à la rencontre et au soutien du chanteur, acteur et militant Harry Belafonte, elle débute une nouvelle vie, mais aux États-Unis. Là-bas, elle donne des concerts et rencontre de nombreuses personnalités, dont Nina Simone, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis ou encore le président John Kennedy, qui l'invite en 62 à chanter pour son gala d'anniversaire. Myriam Makeba est une star suivie dans la rue, photographiée et très demandée. Mais c'est aussi une fervente militante. Deux fois, elle intervient à l'ONU pour demander de faire pression sur l'Afrique du Sud et sa politique d'apartheid. Son militantisme se retrouve également dans ses chansons.
Je suis née et ai été élevée en Afrique du Sud. Et vous savez que la vie des Noirs en Afrique du Sud est plutôt difficile, dans la mesure où ils sont considérés comme des moitiés d'êtres humains. Ainsi, mes chansons, et particulièrement celles d'Afrique du Sud, parlent de ma vie et de celle de mon peuple.
Pour la chanteuse, la musique permet de resserrer les liens entre les cultures, un engagement qu'elle porte notamment sur le continent africain. Myriam Makeba devient une des grandes figures de la lutte panafricaine. Elle chante en swahili, en arabe, en tswana ou en zoulou. Chanter dans d'autres langues lui permet de valoriser toutes ces cultures, mais aussi toutes les traditions musicales des différents pays d'Afrique, mais aussi du monde. Sur scène, elle peut passer d'une chanson en anglais avec un petit rythme un peu jazzy à une chanson en français, puis revenir sur une musique traditionnelle Xhosa et enfin finir avec une berceuse qui vient d'Indonésie. Fin des années 60, Myriam Makeba est mariée à un militant des Black Panthers. Elle ne peut donc plus rester aux États-Unis. Elle s'exile alors en Guinée. En tout dans sa vie, elle recevra une dizaine de passeports diplomatiques. La chanteuse est soit crainte, soit respectée pour ses combats et donc appelée à venir chanter un peu partout sur le continent africain, mais aussi en Europe, notamment en France, où elle est décorée au titre de commandeur des arts et des lettres, puis devient citoyenne d'honneur en 90. Cette même année, à l'appel de Nelson Mandela, Myriam Makeba rentre enfin dans son pays après 30 ans d'exil. Elle continue de chanter, d'enregistrer, de donner des concerts, mais son combat n'est pas terminé. Remains to be my king, and I won't treat you. Oh, well, I sing me a song now. La chanteuse s'investit pour différentes causes. Les enfants atteints du sida, les jeunes filles violées ou isolées, les violences sexuelles envers les femmes, notamment en République démocratique du Congo. Elle soutient aussi l'Italien Roberto Saviano, auteur de Gomorra, et elle donne en 2008 un concert à Naples en son honneur. Après avoir interprété Pata Pata sur scène, elle est victime d'une crise cardiaque et meurt à l'âge de 76 ans. Nelson Mandela écrira alors « Ces mélodies inoubliables ont donné une voix à la douleur de l'exil et de la mise à l'écart. Pendant tout ce temps, sa musique a inspiré un puissant sentiment d'espoir en nous tous. »
So that wraps it up for us once again this week here on Amandla. Thank you so much for joining us. And if you'd like to listen to that interview again or share it with friends who didn't have a chance to hear it, by all means, go to our blog, which is www.amandla.ca, where you will find the best of Amandla. It might take us a couple of weeks to get it up there, but it will be up there. And that's it for us. So please stay tuned now for Jazz Euphoria.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for Amandla this week. This has been a broadcast from a previous show, and we will be back to you when we come back from our travels in Malawi early in April. So with that, I'd ask Gwen to say...
Stay safe, stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium.
Good night.
BTW and live theater is back. Black Theater Workshop and La Manufacture present Pipeline. We are back after 2 years with a dual-language presentation of the off-Broadway hit Pipeline by Dominique Morisseau, translation by Mishka Lavigne. Pipeline shares the story of Nia, a single mother and teacher dedicated to the success of her students and her teenage son Omari. Tensions are mounting at his school, and Nia must find a way to rediscover her connection with her son and his connection with himself. Pipeline will be presented at Théâtre La Licorne from April 12th to 23rd in English and April 26th to May 8th in French. For tickets, call 514-523-2246 or visit théâtrelalicorne.com. This is a Black Theatre Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation.
Cinema Politica invites you to a free in-person screening of Dope is Death, followed by a discussion with director Mia Donovan, April 4th. In 1973, Dr. Mutulu Shakur, along with fellow Black Panthers and the Young Lords, combined community health with radical politics to create the first acupuncture detoxification program in America. This form of radical harm reduction was a revolutionary act towards the government programs that transfix the lives of Black and brown communities throughout the South Bronx. This film tells the story. Join us on Monday, April 4th, 7 p.m., room H110, 1455 de Maisonneuve West. Donations encouraged, cinemapolitica.org, or find us on social media. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.